Please silence all electronic devices.
Members, the nurse of the day today is...
The job we have as legislators is to decide where the lines are.
It is a very sacred and holy institution.
I'll move to amend the bill.
Even the old folks in Devon knew.
He said, hey, ain't you Jesse Harris? And I couldn't deny that. I said, yeah.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
While I do not believe I did anything illegal or ever thought I was doing anything illegal...
You're fired!
North Carolina General Assembly Act.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Dave DeWitt, Managing Editor for News here at WUNC, and I'm here with Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief.
Hi there.
Jess Clark, Jorge Valencia are out today, and they're not the first victims of a long emotional week at the General Assembly, but it's not hard to believe that they could be. The week began with dueling rallies for and against HB 2 on the first day of the General Assembly's short session. Budget discussions began this week. We learned more about what the governor wants, and a federal judge sided with Republicans over voter ID. But first, the dominant topic this week was HB 2, or the bathroom bill, as it's come to be known. So let's start by hearing a few of the voices from those two competing rallies.
My senior pastor reported to me that he had received a telephone call from activists who said that they intended to be present at the 11 o'clock service in our church.
Bishop was the lead sponsor of the bill in the House of Representatives.
I'm prepared to meet whatever comes my way, but I want you to understand that the people who are worshiping in that church need not be abused by those who would carry on this kind of activism.
Justice, this is our moment to reject the politics of fear and division and hate. This is our time. This is our time.
That was Republican Representative Dan Bishop and North Carolina NAACP President William Barber from Monday's rallies for and against HB 2. And Jeff, there are a lot of ways to dissect HB 2, religious, economic, moral, etc. But I want to talk specifically about how the political aspects of it are playing out. Republicans clearly believed passing HB 2 would help them politically. By some accounts, they had internal information that said it could give them a two-point bump leading up to the November elections. But that really hasn't been the case, has it?
Well, I think we're back to this local versus statewide argument. And it seems as though this is playing well within districts. But in terms of what this means for state races, Governor McCrory, Buck Newton, a state senator who's running for attorney general against Democrat Josh Stein, that is the big unknown, of course. And there are other policy things that came up with House Bill 2 this week. I mean, there was the Democratic bill, House Bill 946, that was filed to repeal HB 2. That's now in legislative Siberia. That's in J4, as it's known around the General Assembly, Judiciary 4. That bill is never going to get a hearing, period. Then on the other side, not yet policy or not quite a policy proposal yet, but Tom Apodaca, a powerful Republican from Hendersonville in the western part of the state, the rules chair in the Senate, ostensibly the number two guy in the Senate, Senator Berger's right-hand man, top lieutenant, whatever you want to call it. He floated this idea to an Asheville television station about a voter referendum, putting it before the voters, which is an interesting proposal. And this is somebody that can be wry and flippant and sarcastic and, you know, it wasn't totally clear whether or not he was being serious. It's still not even that clear. But I did chat with him briefly on the floor of the Senate after a session this past week, and here's what he said.
This, the proposed referendum that you talked about yesterday.
Right.
You being serious or you being
flippant? I'm dead serious. And we are looking at it. I don't know if we can get there with the language, but we would like to. And, you know, we've heard from both sides that, you know, everybody's against it or for it. Let's find out and let the people vote.
All of HB 2, just the bathroom provision, what would you like to see?
I think it'll be just the bathroom provision because there's no way to quantify all the other areas. So that would be the main one.
Has it, I know you can't address caucus, how far have those discussions come?
We've had discussions in our caucus about a possible amendment, and there is, our people are receptive to that. That's about it, though. Any changes I don't see right at this moment.
So this is a law that's already on the books.
Yeah.
Why put it before the voters?
Because of all, if I've been here 14 years and I have never seen an issue this contentious. Never. And so let's let the people talk.
What do you think the likelihood of this, a voter referendum moving through this chamber and then the larger and more diverse caucus within the House?
I think if we can get it tied up tightly enough with the language, I think there's a good possibility.
So Apodaca, on one hand, is floating this idea, which is, let's just be honest, and this the way it was described in the press room this week was a shiny object. Like, who's going to follow the shiny object? Which editors are going to jump on the shiny object? There's no way this thing's going to go before the voters, right? Like, this is a law. This is on the books. Why would they put it before the voters? On the other hand, is it a way for them to double down a little bit or back off a little bit? Or to your point about getting back to your question, is this advantageous come November? Does this get people to come out to the polls? We don't know yet how calculated this was, how purposeful this was. He didn't really craft the proposal, Apodaca. I did speak with a political science professor from Western Carolina, Chris Cooper. He offered this.
Tom Apodaca is politically a smart guy, and I think this is a smart move. And I think to some degree this may be a bit of a trial balloon as well. I think he hasn't come out with a lot of details yet, and that may be on purpose, right? I think he's trying to sort of see how this flies with the voters, and my sense is it's going to fly pretty well.
So Cooper, you know, thinks that this is, a purposeful move out of Apodaca. It is worth noting also that this senator is not up for re-election.
Right. He's a legacy guy. And that was my question when I saw it. Now, is he just throwing this bomb as he's walking out the room? Or does he think this is truly one of those things that could help? Because we've seen some polling data about what people think about HB2 in North Carolina, but not a lot and nothing definitive.
Not that I've seen.
But it's probably going to be really close, right? If this thing actually gets to a voter referendum, no one side is going to have a landslide in this.
No, I don't think so. I would be surprised if this ever gets on the ballot. It seems as though, as Cooper mentioned, this is a way for a little bit of cover, and this is something that we expect will end back up in the courts. Coincidentally, you know, I think it's worth noting that there were these rallies that we talked about. That you heard from off the top pertaining to HB2. When the next legal step comes in that case, it's going to be before Judge Thomas Schroeder in the Middle District of North Carolina. And I guess somewhat of a symbolic connection or a cyclical connection, Judge Schroeder is the one who penned this 485-page decision that came out on voter ID this week,
right?
Which is, you know, just the latest of the laws that have been passed by the General Assembly that have ended up, you know, rising through the federal court system.
Right.
And then on to the Fourth Circuit in Richmond. So
and that's he's a Bush appointee.
Beast, but you know, he's.
What's interesting, let's say, you know, politically looking at this,
sure.
If it becomes a voter referendum, then almost every election in North Carolina that's statewide for sure becomes, do you agree or disagree with HB2? Mm-hmm. It makes that the political issue at stake in this state in November. If not, let's say the voter referendum idea doesn't go anywhere, mm-hmm. then it's potential. HB2 will still be an issue for some people, but then a lot of these races might end up being about some other things. And that's certainly probably what Governor Pat McCrory wants. I don't think he would want HB2 to be the defining thing that either gives him a second term or doesn't. And although, you know, Senator Richard Burr hasn't said a lot about HB2, I'll bet he really doesn't want Mm-mm. it to be an issue come November. So it's interesting from a political standpoint. Right. Do you keep HB2 at the top of the voter minds, or do you let it sort of go into the courts, become something that some people would care a lot about and some people wouldn't necessarily? That, to me, is an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, it is an interesting dynamic. And that, of course, is looking at it just through the scope of Jones Street and the General Assembly and the legislators who, admittedly, I'm a sheep to an extent. We run around and we follow what they say and we try to make sense of it and we try to get ahead of the curve, but they do drive the narrative and the conversation to a large extent in state politics. There are other things that, let's just say for argument's sake, the legislators want to move away from HB2. They want to make this about the budget. They want to, there's a looming disagreement. This is totally just taking a right turn for a moment about lottery revenues and how the governor wants to use lottery revenues for educational initiatives. That's something we're going to hear about in the next week. Like, that's totally different. That has nothing to do with HB2. So, the question is, do the lawmakers try to steer away from HB2? And if they do, are they able to keep that the focus, whatever X is, whatever something else is? Or does the NCAA, and we heard from the NCAA this week, say, Greensboro, no NCAA tournament men's basketball games in 2017. Charlotte not going to get them in 2018. Does Adam Silver come out or the NBA come out and say no NBA All-Star game in Charlotte in 2017? Does Corporation X or Performer Y say, yeah, we're not coming to North Carolina? And then the lawmakers don't want to be talking about HB2 anymore, but naturally we are because big things continue to go.
Right, and Governor McCrory is on Fox News. He's on Meet the Press. He's not on there to talk about lottery revenues and how we use those. Mm-hmm. He's there to talk about HB2. And so he's walking this tightrope of, I'm getting a lot of attention for this. That could be good for fundraising in the state and out of the state as he goes up against Cooper here in the fall. But he kind of doesn't want to talk about it, right? So he's using it at the same time he wants to avoid it. And that's also true on the Democratic side. They're using it as much as they can as a political wedge issue. And while we have, like I said, we have some polling on it, there was, I don't know, a sense of miscalculation, certainly from the beginning on the Republican side, of just how much of a thing HB2 would become.
Right. Hopefully this isn't too terrible of an analogy. This was a campfire that has turned into a brush fire.
Right.
And I don't know who has control over it at this point. I don't know if either side or any entity involved knows who really is controlling, you know, how the flames are burning. But this is, it's burning,
right?
And it's going to burn for a while.
Right, because at any time, you know, we don't talk about it for a few days, it looks like it's dying down, and Beyonce decides she's not coming and doing concerts in North Carolina, or something like that happens, and suddenly it becomes a big deal nationally again, or some late night comedian makes a joke,
right,
and it becomes a big thing online. And so it's an interesting issue from that perspective. It's something people feel really passionately about. But on some level, it's also overriding, I don't want to say more important issues, but the other issues that the legislature really is involved in with budgets. We talked about the voter ID.
Sure, more functional policy.
That's
issues.
Right. These are things that in a real honest way will have a broader impact on what's going on in the state. Maybe not more of a direct impact on certain individuals. Certainly this bathroom bill does that. But you know, the more traditional, this is the budget and it has a really dramatic effect
right.
on things.
None that are going to have as much of an impact culturally or perception-wise as HB2 does. But again, we've said this before, we'll say it again here and in news stories and on the state of things. Lawmakers are not going to repeal HB2. I say that with as much certainty as I've said anything related to state politics in the last year. That's just not going to happen.
Right.
Could a voter referendum happen? Yeah. Other things could happen. But yes, we're talking about 500,000 state employees. What kind of raises are they going to get, or performance bonuses, or, you know, will there be a COLA, a cost of living adjustment for all the state retirees? There are functional policy things that at some point are going to get more play. And I'm trying to remember who it was, but it was Senator Buck Newton, who I mentioned before, but he made the comment to me earlier this week that there are better things, in his opinion, there are much better things for this body to be working on, and he would like to go ahead and shift attention to that naturally.
Right. And at the same time, all their campaigns are going to be raising money on this issue. So there is obviously, and that happens with almost every issue that there is. What else is at the top of your mind going into the next week's session and in the coming weeks? What do you think is going to sort of rise to the top, either from an important standpoint or from things that we in the media may be paying attention to?
It's a little wonky, but one thing that will probably get some play moving forward is the IRC, the Internal Revenue Code. This is essentially changes to tax policy in the state. And the Senate pushed a bill through this past week. The House is going to take it up. It will probably be 2 or 3 days of discussions coming up. So that's one functional policy thing that we're going to hear more about. And in terms of the budget, it's worth noting, so the governor puts the budget proposal out there, and you know there are plenty of jokes about what to do with the governor's budget. Do you throw it in the trash? Do you use it as a doorstop? The governor functionally doesn't have legislative power to pass a budget, and with supermajorities in both chambers, he also doesn't have the functional legislative power from passing a budget, or excuse me, from stopping a budget from moving through. So.
Right. He's had his day in the sun, as the budget goes.
Well, he's going to try to have more days in the sun. He's going to try to position and jockey and talk about what he got through and what he didn't get through. But from the budget standpoint, we will hear much more from House representatives in the coming weeks about where to use revenue, how much money, where to use the surplus, how much money to save, and just various nuances of a pretty complicated $22.3 billion spending plan.
Right, and we'll stay on top of that throughout the entire short session, which Senator Berger hopes ends before July 4th, but most people who watch could go longer than that, for sure. Could go longer than that. Many people expect it will. But let's take a little step back, like way back. So one of the interesting things to me is you had a conversation earlier this week about sort of the whole idea of state legislatures and how they compare across the country. You know, we here in North Carolina have sort of a hybrid, you know, people are in session for maybe half a year, sometimes longer, but they aren't full-time positions. They're not designed to be full-time positions. There are some states, like New York, for example, that have full-time state legislators, and it really does affect the lawmaking process. And I found the conversation fascinating. Why don't you tell us who you talked to and why?
Yeah, I spoke with Laura Rose, who is with the National Conference of State Legislatures, and there are a couple of different organizations that follow state governments across the country. This one looks mainly at general assemblies. There's an organization in Kentucky that looks at not only, you know, legislative bodies, but also some of those council of state positions. But Laura Rose in Colorado wanted to chat with her and just kind of get a, you know, a broad general view of some of those differences. It was something for me that, you know, I learned some things from this conversation. I think that a lot of our listeners are civically engaged and know a lot about just the range of full-time versus part-time legislators and maximum days allowed to be debating bills and some of the different procedural things. But it truly is just, it's very different across the board. So here's our conversation.
One of my colleagues says that they're like snowflakes. You know, they are very different. They each have their own personalities, their own traditions, their own feel. You know, when you visit them, you've got just a really different atmosphere depending on where you are in terms of whether they're formal or casual or friendly or not friendly, or, you know, they're all very, very different, even though they all have the same mission. My name is Laura Rose. I am the director of the Legislative Management Program at the National Conference of State Legislatures, and our program is a core program of NCSL. We support the legislative institution with research and training and technical assistance.
I know that there are 99 chambers across the country, and mm-hmm. North Carolina is set to begin its short session here.
Right.
I guess I want to start with the commonalities. What are the similarities, if there are some that come to mind when you think about, you know, state legislative bodies?
Well, I think there are a lot of similarities. I think that most states are similar to North Carolina in that they have generally sessions every year. There are only a few that do not hold session in the even-numbered year. Usually the odd-numbered year tends to be a little bit of a longer session, and then they come back in the next year with more limited bills or a shorter session. And that, I'm speaking very generally right now.
As for the differences, it seems almost as though we have 50 shades of politics across the U.S., mm-hmm. more differences than commonalities. What are some of the bigger differences that strike you as you kind of take a national snapshot of how things are?
Boy, well, I think things that they vary on include some states put limits on numbers of bills that can be introduced by a member. Some states require all bills be heard, and others leave it very discretionary up to the chairperson. So it's really kind of all over the map in that sense.
Well, what about lawmakers, full-time versus part-time? Can you give us a sense of...
There are lots of different kinds of ways that we categorize legislatures. So we have the full-time legislatures. They earn enough of a legislative salary that they can actually exist on that without having another job. They have a lot of staff and that support them and help them do their jobs. And they have longer sessions. Sometimes they meet year-round. Those we call the full, quote, full-time legislatures. The ones that really are obvious would be states like New York, Pennsylvania, California. Those are really the three big ones. Then there's some that are sort of full-time that have enough pay to, you know, conceivably live on, and they have a lot of, but they have a lot of staff, and they might meet most of the year, but not quite as often as the big three. And those are states like Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, Florida, Wisconsin, Massachusetts. And then the hybrid states, of which we consider North Carolina, a hybrid state where they have, you know, they probably spend more than half of their time on being a legislator, but they generally do not have enough to live on. So they, most of the folks that serve in the hybrids tend to have another profession. And the part-time, low-pay, small-staff legislatures are tend to be concentrated in the more of the western states and the northeast, and they are probably half-time or less on their jobs. I don't think any legislator actually spends less than half of their time on their job because there's just so much to do. But these are really the citizen legislatures, and they get very low pay. Their sessions are usually pretty prescribed, like you'll have a 60-day session one year and a 45-day session the next year or something. And they get all their work done within that time period. And those would be, like I said, the really larger western states like Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming. The most common, I would have to say, is probably the hybrid, like North Carolina.
If you're at a cocktail party or a barbecue or Thanksgiving dinner, whatever it may be, are there particular anecdotes or stories or things that you share with other people about various state legislatures that strike you as, I don't know, interesting or funny or quirky or whatever it may be?
Wow. They are all very different. I mean, I think the most interesting ones to me are the ones that are maybe a little less professionalized because their legislators tend to have other jobs, and they bring that perspective to their work. I also think it's very interesting that a place like New Hampshire has 400 plus representatives in their one chamber, and they have no staff, and they do, you know, they have small districts, obviously, because New Hampshire's a small state, and they have 400 of them in the House chamber. Just how they do that, you know, how do they do that? How do they make that work? And it does, I think no matter what type of legislative job you have, you're going to be spending a lot of time at it, even if you only have, you know, 10,000 constituents as opposed to 50,000. It's always a very time-consuming job. And, you know, and then you have states like New Mexico that don't pay their legislators anything. And yet they're expected to do this pretty important work. You know, they're making the budget. They're trying to find money for schools and roads, and they don't get paid any. They're volunteers. It's an interesting structure. But, you know, in most states they do get some salary.
I'm picturing, you know, this large body in New Hampshire. I'm just picturing different things. Are there any state legislatures that are notorious for fighting with one another, or I guess on the other end of the spectrum,
oh yeah,
being really civil with one another? What does that snapshot look like?
Well, here I don't really want to single out any particular states.
All right.
But I guess I have seen differences myself. I will say there's a certain baseline that exists in every legislature, and when in the event that a legislator crosses over that line, they would get disciplined for it. You know, if you call somebody a name or use bad language, you're going to get called on that. And most legislatures have internal procedures for keeping their members in line. And it's all very internal. You know, it's specific to legislatures are, you know, basically self-governing in the sense of behavior. And you know, if someone does something wrong, they have consequences for that. And so I would say that at least when they're meeting on the floor, there are certain rules that are adhered to for the most part. Then what happens outside of that varies, I think, a little bit more. And a lot of it depends on factors that are, you know, I'm going to say like the economic conditions in the state. Like if you're very tight on money and you have to make cuts or you're going to have more tension. You know, if your economy is good, it's going to be easier. You know, I think that has a lot to do with it.
Okay, that's Laura Rose with the National Conference of State Legislatures talking to Jeff Tiberi earlier this week. And what I found fascinating about that conversation, Jeff, is this sort of idea of how these state legislatures just kind of evolved, or not even evolved, they were set in their ways some time ago as whether they would be full-time legislators, part-time, a hybrid, somewhere in between, whether they would do things quickly or whether it would take a long time. And that really has an impact on daily life here in North Carolina, how much time gets spent on the budget and when these special sessions are called, like what's called for HB2. And it's one of those things I think regular people, even really well-informed, civically minded people, as you said, just don't think about all that much.
Absolutely. And to that point, maybe extending it a little bit further, it also affects who can serve in a legislature, right?
Right.
Full-time legislatures, California and New York. I did ask Laura about this. This wasn't in the interview that folks just heard. She said there's a loose correlation between full-time legislatures and getting people of a little bit more professional diversity. Mm-hmm. For example, there at this point, I think there's one doctor who was appointed last October to the General Assembly. A lot of the lawmakers are lawyers and business people,
retired,
independently wealthy, retired. Not a lot of teachers, per se. I mean, how could you be a fourth grade teacher and serve in the,
right,
the General Assembly? I mean,
right,
there are former educators in the body. But it is, and it varies greatly. And there's not a lot of rhyme or reason to say, oh, the blue states are this way and the red states are this way or the southern states are this way. I mean, it's really a fluid continuum across the country of how these bodies work, who's in them, how long they meet for. Louisiana, for example, I think it's they're capped at like 45 days a year of legislative conversations, debates, meetings, which, you know, that's less. They do that here every year.
Right.
So,
yeah, that's not a short session. That's just a session
right,
for them. And that
right,
changes how you make laws. Well, that was fascinating. Thanks for doing that. And that'll be it for the WUNC Politics podcast this week. Make sure to subscribe on our website, WUNC.org, and follow all of the WUNC Politics stories from Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for being on today, Jeff.
Thanks.
Jorge Valencia, Jess Clark will be back next week. And listen to those stories again on air and online. Thanks so much.